I want to look in this lecture at the concept of the public and the private sphere. In considering these concepts, we join the debate created by Jürgen Habermas in his book, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere. This was published in German in 1962 and translated into English in 1989. The public sphere, according to Habermas, is the space which emerged around 1700 between the sphere of public authority, which included the state, and the private realm. Whereas previously the public sphere had been understood to be a sphere of state authority, it was now, in the 18th century, casting itself loose as a forum in which the private people came together to form a public. Habermas's is currently the most influential model of the rise of public opinion as a social and political force in the state. This is because it offers an explanation that can account for the flourishing of the great Enlightenment thinkers and for the dissemination of their ideas to a wider audience. He dates the emergence of the public sphere as arising first in Great Britain at the turn of the 18th century, and mentions three events which occurred in 1694-5 as marking the beginning of the process. These were the founding of the Bank of England, the end of the licensing system, and the introduction of cabinet government. Habermas's arguments have been challenged. According to Alan Downey, there are problems with each of the key events cited by Habermas. He said that he could quibble about the accuracy of almost every sentence he wrote about 17th and 18th century Britain. Historians of Europe have also said that a public sphere existed on the continent too. And Peter Lake and Steve Pinkers have recently argued that the public sphere emerged in the post-Reformation period, dating from the 1530s through to the 1630s. However, whatever date we give to the public sphere, it does certainly seem to have emerged in England by the early 18th century. I want now to look at four key institutions of the public sphere, according to Habermas. The first of these is coffee houses. By the first decade of the 18th century, London already had 3,000 of them. Richard Sennett, a sociologist, argued that the cardinal rule governing coffee house conversation was that anyone sitting in a coffee house had a right to talk to anyone else, to enter into any conversation, whether he knew the other people or not, whether he was bidden to speak or not. Thus, coffee house conversation produced an ideal of liberty without governance. Entry was open to anyone willing to pay the penny admission fee, and the rules of conversation were posted on the door. Thus, for Habermas and Sennett, the coffee house was the place of a new form of sociability, characterised by freedom of speech. However, John Barrell has recently argued that no more than a handful of early 18th century coffee houses can have come close to Habermas's or Sennett's ideal, arguing that the vast majority must have been little local cafes, often in basement rooms and open for only for a few hours a day, patronised by tradesmen on their way to work, who no more expected to be drawn into a discussion of Shakespeare's neglect of the unities than to be offered a latte when they ordered a milky coffee. The second institution I want to look at then is print culture. By 1704, there were 9 newspapers in London and 3 in the country, with a circulation of some 45,000 copies. Montesquieu had been struck by the number and the licentiousness of the London newspapers. He was also impressed by the ease which their information reached working men, writing that the slaters had the newspapers brought onto the roofs of the houses that they were working on so they could read them. Alongside newspapers were the more serious and intellectual books, broadsides and debates. Viscount Bolingbroke acknowledged the power of these when he wrote in The Craftsman, When the people find themselves generally aggrieved, they are apt to manifest their resentments in political ballads, allegories, by-sayings, and ironical points of low wit. The third institution I want to look at is the emergence of salons. These represent a web of voluntary association and informal sociability, found not only in salons but in scientific societies, coffee houses, literary and philosophical societies, theatres and Masonic lodges. Habermas defined two types of public: the world of letters, where private individuals in their capacity as human beings communicated, and the political realm, where private people in their capacity as owners of commodities communicated through rational critical debate. Women and their dependents were often legally excluded from the political public sphere, but took a more active part in the literary public sphere. The most famous literary salons in England were those of the so-called Blue Stocking Circle, which emerged in the 1760s and 1770s. The leaders of this circle were people like Hester Chapone, Elizabeth Carter, Catherine Talbot, and Elizabeth Montagu. Although they were non-political, they did lead to the development of a feminine public voice and paved the way for more explicitly political writers such as Catherine Macaulay and Mary Wollstonecraft. Salons straddled the private, semi-private, and public realms. They were female-managed arenas where women could participate alongside men on equal terms. It was in these semi-public spaces that women's voices could be heard. The last institution I want to look at is debating societies. These societies were commercial ventures that regularly advertised their topics of debate in newspapers. In 1780 alone, 418 different debates were advertised. The societies emerged in the early 18th century, beginning as convivial clubs of 50 or so men, meeting once a week in pubs, largely discussing affairs of state and religious issues. There were also mooting clubs established by law students and the so-called spouting societies for trainee actors. By the 1770s, many of these debating societies were leaving the pubs and re-establishing themselves in genteel rooms. In these later societies, women were welcomed, integrated into men's societies, but also there were clubs opened where only women could speak. Debating societies were important for spreading Enlightenment ideas amongst a wide popular audience and creating a new public sociability. However, they also raised much opposition for the nature of their debates, their participants, and the role of women. I want to turn now to the private sphere. There has been a tendency in some applications of Habermas's theory to oversimplify the relationship between the public and private spheres. This is in part due to the ambiguities in Habermas's own use of the terms. Sometimes he refers to the bourgeois private sphere that opposes itself to the publicness of state authority. At other times, the sphere of the market is referred to as private. He wrote, "The sphere of the market we call private. The sphere of the family as the core of the private sphere we call the intimate sphere." Thus, the connections between the public and private spheres are ambiguous. Habermas used the example of the single family house with its own public and private spaces as a metaphor for the whole. The line between the public and private sphere extended right through the home. He used architectural records to show that the bourgeois household was split into private areas for family members and salons for social activities and business meetings. Lastly, I want to turn to the connection between Habermas, the public sphere, and gender. Habermas emphasised the importance of patriarchy within the family. His public sphere was entirely masculine, with women participating in what he called the literary public sphere of reading novels and attending salons and debating societies. Joan Landers, in an influential study of Habermas and gender in the French context, argued he did not see how gender was central to the very construction of the public sphere. However, she argued that the bourgeois public sphere was of no benefit to women. They were driven out of public life and contained within the household. The threat to patriarchy was neutralised by a sharper polarisation of gender and a more emphatic gendering of separate spheres. It's this rhetoric of separate spheres and whether it reflected the reality of gender relations in Georgian Britain that we shall turn to in the next lecture.